Hi, I'm Sean. I've always been curious about the answers to life's big questions. I thought it would be cool to seek some of those answers through conversations with others on a similar path. I started this podcast with a simple mission. I want to help you improve your life. These conversations are meant to challenge you, make you think, and inspire you to pursue the things in life that light you up. I've always believed that with the right mix of effort and perseverance, anything truly is possible. I'd like to invite you to think outside the lines. What's up, everybody? We are back after a brief hiatus, and I am so excited to share these new episodes with you. Now, as you know, my mission with this show has always been to help you design the life you deserve. And my guests today want to help you do just that. Their mission is to encourage self-reflection and assist individuals in challenging their most deeply held beliefs without leading them to specific answers. They've written an amazing book called The Pragmatist's Guide to Life, which helps readers take a deeper dive into self-discovery from the perspective that who you are is either who you choose to be or who you've allowed yourself to become. They are a married couple who split their time between Miami and Peru while running their travel companies. I had a ton of fun with this interview, and I really think you're going to enjoy our conversation. And because there's so much insight here, I'm going to share the conversation with you in two parts, so look for part two later in the week. And now, it's time to think outside the lines with Malcolm and Simone Collins. Welcome to the show, Malcolm and Simone Collins. How are you today?
We are doing spectacular.
I love it. Now, I'm going to start by saying that you are the first couple to ever appear on the show, and that this is actually the first time I've interviewed two people at once. So congratulations, and also bear with me.
Ooh, how exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Now, each of your bios are actually incredibly interesting, and we're going to dive into some of that a bit later. But I actually want to begin with the story of how you guys met, because I think it's actually quite fascinating.
Oh, and tomorrow is our 6-year anniversary. So we've been thinking a lot about it.
Do you want to tell the story, Simone?
Sure. Yeah. Gosh. Okay. So to put it as succinctly as I can.
In context. Put it in context.
In context. I had turned 24 years old and had basically figured out everything about my life. I mean, I had a good job. I had life insurance, savings, emergency fund. I traveled internationally twice a year. I had, you know, my hobbies and my friends and parties. And I decided, okay, now I'm prepared to experience love, because before I had never dated anyone or had sex or, you know, like none of that nonsense, because I just couldn't be bothered. But I still intended to live alone forever, but I still needed to be able to tell people, oh, well, you know, I've tried it and it's underwhelming. So my goal for that year was to fall in love and have my heart broken, just to get it, you know, get it done. And
so, just to be clear, you set this
Malcolm
as an intention.
She couldn't convince herself to date, so she built a system to force herself to date, which was a competition she had in her office for points based on what you did with people on a date and like whether you got asked out again. And then she built a separate point-based system because she was too timid to say no to people on a second date. So the second point-based system was based entirely around triaging partners she didn't want to see again.
Right. So, and for that, it was a 0 to 50 scale. And for the first 16 first dates that I went on that year up to when I met him on March 18th, the average score was a 16. So out of 50, that's not really great. And Malcolm scored a 42. But first date was really interesting in the sense that he sat me down over dinner at an Indian restaurant in San Francisco and said, well, I'm not really looking to date right now. I'm looking to find a wife, but I think I'll find her this fall at Stanford.
Hold on. For further clarification, what I really said is, I want to be honest with you. There's a large pre-vetted pool of female candidates there. And therefore, it's a very great sort of hunting ground for me for finding a wife.
Yeah.
And it means that any of the dating I do, leading up to that is going to be treated less seriously than other dating. I was just putting all my cards on the table up front. And I was implementing a crazy dating strategy as well right then. For the past, you know, 3 years up to that, and I was sort of nearing the end of the window I had set for myself. I was doing a high throughput dating strategy, which meant, you know, I was trying to go on at least 5 dates a week. Often, you know, get 3 or 2 dates in a day on weekends. And the reason I call it high throughput is when you're looking for an antigen to bind to a specific you know, shape on a protein. One of the strategies they use is they just combine them with like a billion potential antigens and see which one binds, and that's how they find the right antigen, and these are used in vaccines and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was doing with a wife. I was just like, okay, match me with all of them and let's see which one binds.
Yeah, so, I mean, he said that and I instantly fell in love with him. But before we had sex, like a couple dates later, I sort of forced him to promise to break up with me. Both because it seemed convenient, right? I mean, he was going to find his wife at Stanford, and because I knew it would break my heart. And of course, I really wanted to stay single. I even wrote myself letters during the dating process that I needed to open after the breakup date that said, Simone, you better stay away from him. Don't get back with him. And of course, I ignored them all. But he did actually break up with me.
Because you made me promise in writing that I would break up with you, Simone.
And so he did. And then we got back together, and it's been a wild adventure ever since.
Okay, I feel like I want to do an entire podcast on, like, this topic alone, just because I'm right there with you. I've always believed that, like, dating personally is a numbers game, right? And so, like, as someone that's, like, I've been single for a few years now, and I really do feel that, like, it's probability, right? It's like, okay, if the more dates I go on, the more likely I am to meet, like, the person that's right for me. But I feel like you guys just infuse, like, a whole nother element into the process, and so... We're gonna have to go into that some other time, because
oh goodness, I would love to talk more about the book that we're writing right now is on relationships and dating, and so it's a topic that we're really thinking a lot about these days.
Oh my God, yes, I would love to talk about this in more in depth. Yeah, that's really cool. So I'm gonna go back to the question that I usually start with all my guests, you're both welcome to answer this. So if you have a collective answer, you're welcome to answer it however you wish. But tell me what you believe to be the message that you were brought here to share with the world.
At least in the context of the first book we wrote, in sort of the foundation run, we call this sort of your objective function, which we define as the collection of things you're trying to maximize with your life and how you weight those various things. But when we talk about sort of the specific thing that we're trying to change in the world right now, through our nonprofit and stuff like that, we think one of the core problems in the world today, and it's caused a lot of problems politically, it's causing a lot of problems socially, and it's not just confined to this country, is that people aren't taught how to be wrong or how to change their mind and how to look for evidence that they might be wrong about a belief they hold deeply. And even if they know how, society then shames them for updating their beliefs based on a new worldview or new evidence. And this has caused the various sort of ideologies within this country and within other countries to become increasingly polarized and unable to see the other side's perspective at all.
Yeah.
And we're trying to fix that. And nobody's trying to fix it. There is no foundation that says, look, we don't have an agenda here. We just want to train people to be more comfortable changing their mind and provide them with the heuristics that they need to sort of
best ideas win.
Yeah, come up with their own set of beliefs and use that to create heuristics that make their decisions for them.
Yeah, and, you know, I love the work that you guys are doing, and I'm so excited for this conversation because I feel that probably more than anything else right now, this is the conversation that the world needs to hear. You say that your goal is to encourage self-reflection and assist individuals in challenging their most deeply held beliefs without leading them to specific answers, and that as humans, we get to choose what we believe and who we want to be, and that these are the most important decisions we'll ever make. Now, I feel like this message, I feel like this message is more important than ever. Again, like I said, but I wonder if it comes with a caveat in the present day of like these alternative facts that we find ourselves living in.
I mean, so our viewpoint on this issue is it is a really, I think, tough environment to be in from a political standpoint.
Yeah.
Because, and I did not feel this way before, and this has been at least a major sort of worldview shift for me, I think, in the past year, that I don't really trust any news sources anymore. At first, I was in the San Francisco environment. I was caught up with the tribalism of the liberal perspective. And I thought there are fake news sources spreading fake news that has misled a portion of the population.
Yeah.
And the thing that really changed my perspective and was a huge learning moment for me was when every legitimate news source that I was treating as these are the legitimate sources said something that was provably false, which is that Donald Trump isn't going to win and that Donald Trump can't win. And as soon as I saw that all of them had created this incorrect fantasy world, it made me think, what else have I been believing that they were telling me that was wrong?
Interesting.
And then what we advocate for is to be very equal in terms of giving opportunities to any idea, especially ideas that seem offensive. If you feel offended by something, no matter who you are, it's both because that concept hurts your sense of reality, your values, perhaps your sense of self, or threatens it at least, but also because you feel like it has maybe some weight. Because if it didn't, you know, if I was just like, well, you're awful green, and then you take huge offense to that, I mean, you wouldn't, because you're not green.
You're just like,
that's
silly. It offends you because it challenges your worldview.
Right. So, I mean, if someone told me, just let's find a weird example, like drowning puppies is actually really good for society and everyone should be doing it, I might take offense to that because that seems really wrong to me. And I also think puppies are adorable. And how could you possibly do that? But I would still, what we're trying to advocate for, step back, say, okay, let's actually find out if somehow drowning puppies is good for people. Let's hear out whoever just said that. Let's see what evidence they use to back themselves up. Let's run that against what I consider to be valid evidence. And hey, I mean, if I was wrong and drowning puppies really is better for society, I want to know.
That's been one of our biggest sort of journeys recently, is all of these things that offended us and we refused to mentally engage with because they were offensive to us, we started engaging with and realized that it might not be that they're totally right, but they had merit that we had never fully considered.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, you'll probably get a new perspective on something and better understand perhaps an inherent problem that's causing people to behave in a way you don't like. You know, maybe white supremacists, for example, are really wrong about some things, but really right about other things. But if we don't actually have a dialogue, if we don't actually look at the issues they're discussing, how are we going to solve the problems? How are we going to reduce that tribalism? How are we going to reduce conflict? How are we going to make everyone better off?
Yeah, you know, okay, so here's the thing. I'm so aligned with where you're going and what you're saying here. I think the difference for me becomes, let's take the argument, and I don't want to spend the whole conversation talking about Trump, because what you guys are doing, I think, is much bigger than that. But let's take the argument that, like, I believe that Donald Trump has obstructed justice, even beyond, like, the Russia stuff, right? And I think there's a clear argument.
Yeah.
There's a clear case that can be made for that. But yet you have this whole
several.
Or several, literally, especially as of this morning. So I think that, like, what's interesting about that, though, is, like, a logical person, i.e. myself, probably you guys, I'm assuming, align with this, but, like, can make that argument, right? But then there's this whole subset of people that are just in denial, and they don't even want to see those facts. So I get the point that you're making in terms of, like, we should be open to seeing, you know, someone's side of things or whatever, but what if that side has just truly been misinformed and they're not even prepared to have a realistic, logical conversation around those topics?
Well, yeah, but you've already gone through that logical thought process. You've thought, okay, wait, these people have a different view.
Yeah.
What information are they looking at? Oh, wait, they're not looking at any information. It looks like they're just reading these, you know, two news channels that are somehow misrepresenting facts.
I think that sort of our viewpoint on this sort of stuff is, we can't always convince other people. Like, it's a lot harder to convince other people to look where they might be systematically believing false information when we're not always willing to do that ourselves. And I think that because both sort of sides of the political spectrum have their blind spots, it's very easy for the opposing side to say, well, you're not looking at your blind spot, so I'm not looking at my blind spot.
Totally.
And I think that if you actually engage When I've engaged Trump supporters about this specific issue, I think it's actually the vast minority of them who, when they're being sort of honest with you, will say, I don't believe he obstructed justice.
Yeah,
what they'll say is, he did, but I don't really think it matters, totally. And I understand how a reasonable person could make those decisions in those moments without necessarily being evil or without necessarily having a malicious intent towards our government. And I think that when you're willing to sort of engage with that argument and how they're seeing it, then you understand the real way to argue against them, which isn't, well, don't you see he obstructed justice, but, well, don't you see that, you know, reasonably, if you keep doing things in this specific manner, it could lead to bigger problems. But we all sort of go straight to hyperbole, and it causes problems in terms of engagement. Because I think that both sides sort of pretends like the other side doesn't see some of the flaws in their argument when they do.
Yeah, whereas now they're really punished. Politicians are punished for changing their minds.
People are punished.
For flip-flopping on stuff.
Like, if you got in that conversation with someone and you admitted that anything was wrong on your side and the conversation became about how your side was wrong, you know, you'd leave the conversation feeling dejected and they would feel even more confirming of their own beliefs, which means that nobody's rewarded to behave responsibly.
And I would argue that that's actually, I think that in many ways that perpetuates itself, right? Because you're so strong in your beliefs and you feel you'll be scolded if you are open-minded or change your mind on a particular topic. And so it almost causes people to double down in some instances, which is maybe more of the conversation that we need to be having about why it's okay to change your mind, right? Or see a different perspective.
Yeah, to avoid that polarization and tribalization that causes so many problems.
Yeah, of course. I want to talk about social media for a second, because I think in the realm of the work that you guys are doing, I think social media probably plays a really important role, and I want to get your take on that.
That's a tough one. I would say that we don't have that much. I mean, we used to be social media people. I proposed to my wife on Reddit, so, you know, we're that level ingrained with social media in terms of being consumers and engagers with communities.
Yeah.
But we don't have social media presences anymore. I mean, you used to be an okay known YouTuber, but...
No, not really.
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people argue that, you know, this is an echo chamber that makes everything worse.
I don't think that I don't think that social media is the problem at all.
Really?
And I think that a lot of us look to social media as an excuse, but I'm like, okay, well then what about your friends who you actually engage with, who you actually have political conversations with, who you actually talk about like tough topics with? And the reality is most people maybe have one friend who they talk to more than once a week where they engage on these topics. And that hasn't changed for hundreds of years.
Oh, it's changed immensely.
No. It changed in hundreds of years. That 100 years ago, people probably only had one friend that seriously disagreed with them about any topic that they cared about.
Gotcha.
Yeah, quite possibly.
I mean, if you look at the founding fathers, you know, we can get a very good idea of how people in the past did discuss these sorts of ideas. And we can see that it was very much just as polarized and very much just as cliquish.
But what is different now, and what I love about social media, is that for the first time ever, we can get access to extremely disparate views and lifestyles. I mean, before, sure, you could talk to everyone around you, maybe talk to people on the phone, read the New York Times. But now I can, you know, watch the vlog of someone in Bangladesh who has really different views from me, and that makes a huge difference.
That is, yeah, I actually think that that's why social media is so powerful, is that it provides us, if we want to, if we're willing to say, I might be wrong about something, something just offended me that I saw somewhere, and it's a community that I would never normally engage with, that plays no part in my regular life, but something about what they said I found threatening to my worldview. Now, without having to do the hard part of, you know, walking into one of their crazy events or whatever and engaging them one-on-one, you can go and watch their YouTube videos. You can see the conversations they're having with each other on Reddit and get a really good understanding of where they're coming from in a fairly short time period.
So I would say that it's a double-edged sword, though, because I agree with what you're saying, but the problem is that most people aren't actively seeking out someone with a different opinion to have them elaborate on their opinion, right?
That's a cultural issue. That's not a social media issue.
Yeah, but I don't think that existed before social media either.
Yeah, it didn't. Not really.
I mean, it didn't really exist before social media. The only thing that's I think the core cultural thing that's changed is The value in being moderate in your beliefs and the value in considering the other side used to be a culturally valuable thing. I mean, you can watch these, you know, old Republican talk show hosts and stuff like that, and they were really willing to mentally engage with the other side. But today, you know, you can't have certain political opinions expressed on college campuses. You know, people will run and pull the fire alarm because it's offensive to them and they don't want to hear other ideas.
Sure.
And both sides have gone to this extreme. And that's what has changed. I don't think it's that social media has changed. I think it's that we now are culturally okay with the idea of not listening to something.
Of intolerance.
Yeah, because we don't agree with it.
Hmm.
Not mentally engaging. It's become cool.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I really do agree with that, but I think that there's a huge difference between, I look at like a Tammy Loren or someone like that, who, yes, is just entitled to like have her beliefs about things, but if they're not coming from a place of truth or education, then is there really value in having that person, you know, speak their opinion? And I...
Well, what I really love about people speaking opinions that I find to be wrong, at least in a place where there's good public discourse, is when you actually allow that discourse to happen and weak, poor, bad ideas are introduced, they get beat up. They get brutalized. And I think that really is the best way to inoculate a population against a bad idea or a harmful idea.
Yeah, it's to watch the idea be had and then watch the people in the audience take it down point by point.
Yeah, because the problem is when we don't consider for ourselves, independently, through actual engagement, the merits or downsides of an idea, we are more susceptible to it without thinking, and we may accept bad ideas.
But the problem is that the people that are taking it down point by point are not the people on, like, her team, for example, right? So you've still got the people that are on her side of the perspective or the viewpoint that are like, oh, look what she, you know, she went in there and told those liberals or whatever, and it's like they're still... We're still not hearing each other, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make. So,
yeah.
That's the problem to be solved, I feel like, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, especially, I think that even just talking about somebody going to a college campus, it's such a, right now, when somebody goes to a college campus, I almost don't even understand the motivation to go to a speaker when you know you already agree with their viewpoints. Like, I can't even understand why you would go to that.
It just makes you feel good about yourself.
And I would argue
to
that's
get affirmation that you're right.
But I would argue that's social media. That's what I go on Twitter when I see breaking news on, you know, whether it's a notification that comes up on my device or whatever. The first thing I do is I go to Twitter and I read through all the people that think like me and agree with me, right? And that's part of the problem, I think, is that, to your point, maybe I need to go to like the Fox News Twitter account or website,
yes,
and see what they're saying about it. But we're not doing that. We're not. And I don't want to do that, to be quite frank with you. I know what they're going to say about it, and I don't want to align with that. So
by how fun it can be and how lightning it can be.
I think the problem is that a lot of people think the solution to this problem is the solution you're saying, which is to listen to news sources that you don't necessarily agree with.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a bit of a red herring solution to this problem.
Totally.
Because the reality is, I see news break, and I can predict how one news source is going to cover it and how another news source is going to cover it. And so if I've read the liberal version, I know what the conservative version is going to be, you know, at this point. And I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
So you're not really getting new information by doing that. I find the areas where I have really transformed my opinion on things more is when I have some sort of holistic political ideology. Like, let's say, when I might use this as an example, something like my views on gun control, right? And I say, okay, what do I believe about this? What information would I need to change my mind on this subject? And have I ever looked for that information? And where would I find it if it existed? And so that allows me to just sort of holistically take a couple hours and about a topic I care. And it helps you. Like, if after doing that, you still have your same opinion on a subject, you're going to be better at convincing other people of that opinion. Like, it is good for your opinion to mentally engage in sort of a deep dive. But I think that sort of shallow skimming of news as it comes at you doesn't really inform our opinions that much.
All right, I want to thank Simone and Malcolm for joining me today. I'd also like to thank you for listening. Now, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to share this episode with anyone you think could benefit from hearing it. Now, you can always find the links for everything we talk about in the show notes, which can be found over at thinkoutsidethelines.com. And feel free to drop me a line with any questions or feedback on the show. You can send an email to hello@thinkoutsidethelines.com. Until next time, go out there and pursue your passion today, because the best way to predict the future is to create it. For more information, please visit thinkoutsidethelines.com.